Blog Talk Radio. Hello everyone, welcome to Masonic Effects. Sometimes with a good idea, you can't just let it up, you can't give it up until you get some results or you find out where it could take you. Fantastic. I think Freemasonry is speaking to us all. Welcome to back to Masonic Effects today. We're going to start today with a bit of a headshot. This is like a way of bringing us all together. I've got an interesting commentary today. It's the 178th day of the year. We only have 188 remaining. And we're plunging forward to the autumnal equinox on the 22nd of September. Yeah, summer's arrived in the Northern Hemisphere, and we've passed the solstice. I haven't heard that there's been much. The axis of the Earth was shaking greatly, but it could happen. Here's a poem by T.S. Eliot, just to get us in an interesting frame of mind. Called the Hollow Men. Perhaps you've heard it. A penny for the old guy. We are the Hollow Men. We are the stuffed men, leaning together, headpiece filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass. Or rats feed over broken glass in our dry cellar. Shape without form, shade without color, paralyzed voice, gesture without motion. Those who have crossed with direct eyes to death's other kingdom remember us, if at all, not as lost, violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. Eyes I dare not meet in dreams, in death's dream kingdom. These do not appear. The ear, the eyes are sunlight on a broken column. There is a tree swinging and voices are in the wind singing, more distant and more solemn than a fading star. Let me be no nearer to death's dream kingdom. Let me also wear such deliberate disguises, rats coat, crow skin, cross staves in a field, behaving as if the wind behaves, no nearer, not that final meeting in the twilight kingdom. Between the idea and the reality, between the motion and the act, falls the shadow of thine is the kingdom. Between the desire and the spasm, between the potency and the existence, Between the essence and the descent falls the shadow, for thine is the kingdom. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. It's sad, that poem by Eliot was written in concerning the post-World War I Europe. Yeah. Makes you think, why would I bring that up on a beautiful sunny day here in this part of the Northern Hemisphere? Why? Guys, just because of that, it made me think, oh, I'm not particularly into ancestor worship. And I don't remember all the battles and every battle. The current one is always the most striking, I think. But just like in the old days, there would be times, because of communication being what it was, unless I was scooped up by the press gang, there would be a lot of military activity going on, and I wouldn't really have, as an average man, I wouldn't have much notice of that. I get word of mouth in the marketplace from time to time, maybe a pamphlet. But major battles, things that would affect not only my life, but the, you know, reorganization of our culture, the influences on our world around us, would be happening without me having any idea. I'm not so sure knowing about it and seeing it spun on the media every morning and afternoon and night makes much of a difference. Except in days gone by, I would have went about my business without trepidation. There wasn't some sword of Damocles hanging over my head, wondering how the battle, whether we would, the English would beat the French, or the Catholic queen would beat the Protestant king. It was day's work as usual. Sun comes up, sun goes down. What then is the benefit of the cost and price of the knowledge? The benefit of that anxiety. Do I worry about it? Oh, should I? Should I be informed? Should I compete with that swell of that glut of knowledge that's out there? Or should I be as informed as I need to be? Should I be a more authentic version of who I am? And whether that suits the sensibilities of other people, so be it. We live in a world of experts. You notice that. But when I think about whether we've made gains or not, I don't know if that's the true purpose of expertise. Because I think only in hindsight, history may be kind to us, and we may have a part to play in progress, getting ahead. Kind of funny in a way that this social experiment of capitalism has given us reason to consider our actions only if we can understand the fairly immediate profit, short-term profit. What is the gain? Our universities are being tested, pushed to validate their curriculum, their coursework, by full attendance and this sense of market position. Know what the market requires, educate our youth to meet those needs. Great thinking. Except in 2008, when we saw the example of what happens when we don't. When we stopped teaching putting an emphasis on the social sciences and philosophy. Oh, I'm speaking, of course, about the ethical wreckage of the economic apocalypse, where those men and women who produce little but the trade, the profit based on the trade, the exchange of currencies and capital, overextended, and that bubble burst. Once again, it always does. Was I any better off had I understood that? And there were scientists that predicted that, of course. How would life have been different with that knowledge? Well, it wouldn't, in a major way, for the those of us who run through the everyday, the agora, it wouldn't have made a great deal of difference. If it is hard to imagine saying something unique or adding an interesting thought about the craft that hasn't already been said. Today's commentary is on what defines us. Our Freemasonry moving forward. Moving, striding, lurching. History has held a kind villainy for Freemasonry. Remnants of our past have been remembered with zeal that would make a Reconstructionist blush. Why is so much attention drawn to ambivalent beginnings? I don't know. The rootstock was grown in the enriched soil of philosophy, high art, culture, mathematics, and that great assault on the unknown, science. All great thinkers were Masons. But Freemasonic thought owes much to men and women who were courageous enough to reveal their findings to the world and face ridicule and worse. Oh yeah, we're in that group. Does the Lodge stand amazed at their works? Can we read a piece of ritual without finding links to antiquity, to ancient thinking? To say our values are shaped by Freemasonic ethos is to say we had never lived our life. We are a product of contemporary thinking in a secular nation confronted always by the pious, devout, and zealous. You know, that group that just wants to launch the canonic laws on us, to live according to the canons. Oh, you remind me that history taught us how oppressive that was, and how exhausting it was, and how it suffocated the creativity and purpose and meaning and reason. Yeah, you'd be right. That confrontation goes on. How then do we don the cloak of reason without penetrating the subject, though through our study and dialogue in and outside the lodge? The subject? When we accept the knowledge at initiation, the exception, free and accepted, we are drawn to our true nature. Am I authentic to myself? Or was Strauss' enduring opera, The Rosenkavalier, written about me? Now, I want to be brave. I've got the uniform. I don't want to go into battle. I want to hide. Rosenkavalier. Have a listen. Quite compelling. We all search in little bits and ways. Here. Just a little soft music to put your mind at ease here for a second. Some of you may recognize this voice. Goes back into the 50s.
I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you.
None other than Marilyn Monroe.
I wanna
It's become a symbol of the tragedy of glamour. Some of you will be old enough to recognize that. The rest, to Google it. Wonderful movie. Here. In the past, the first universal source of experience, the past, you think about it, seekers like you and me hope to find clues to life's meaning and purpose. Just isn't that the most Masonic thing you've ever heard? And in the Old Testament, the ancient Hebrews left the most influential interpretation of the past ever to come to the West. Though it was the book of human destiny, the story belonged to the Creator. His works of creation, his mercy, or his wrath. The story of the Creator's covenant with his chosen people told how he rewarded or punished their response to his commands. The ancient Greek view of the past, the next great tradition for interpreting history, offered a stark contrast. Their heroic epics were tales of human deeds, despite the whims of gods and goddesses. In this, as in everything else, the Greeks found their own way and marked new paths that we still follow. For the ancient Hebrews, there was no doubt of how or by whom future events would be governed. The ancient Greeks explored the uncertainty of man's moral purpose. We think of the future as what lies before us, and the past as behind us. But the ancient Greeks, as Bernard Knox observes, took an opposite view. For them, behind or back, opiso in Greek, referred not to the past, but to the future. They saw their past and their present so plainly and vividly in front of them that it is no wonder that they thought of the unknown and invisible future as behind them. Think about that just a second. If the past was ahead of you, what would your experience be? In the Odyssey, Homer describes a wise old man as the only one who sees what is in front and what is behind. Naturally, then, they saw themselves backing into the future. That means that the future was known to them. Long before they began writing what we call history, they had found their own vivid and persuasive way of organizing and interpreting the past. Their heroic myths, no mere tales of long past happenings, became sacred texts of morality and religion. And long before they had invented the history of writing, they had a confident and traditional view of the past that they could plainly see before them. For the ancient Greeks, it was myth, the heroic epic that gave their real past and memorable form and filled it with meaning. In the reach for experience, the first universal source is tradition. Think about that as a Mason. In the reach for experience, the first universal source is tradition. What grandparents told parents and what parents tell children. But for their tradition, the Greeks did not rely on the casual spoken word heard at the mother's knee. In heroic myths, perpetuated by deathless poetry, it just lives. They gave their past an enduring charm and what would seem an endless resource of meaning. While we see their myths as the realm of fantasy, for classic Greeks, these were the treasured record of their past. Myth gave tradition its memorable drama. In myths, all people learn of ancient times beyond everyday experience, of superhuman creatures and miraculous events. Unlike historical events, these need no proof. The value of a myth. Their survival in the sacred word makes myths the first authentic story of purpose, of first causes, and origins. Now I just challenge you, what myths exist in the exception that you are handed? Of course. While our own modern Western society has not been fertile of myth, true, fortunately we have inherited the myths of ancient Greece. Familiar in our education, they brighten our lives. In them we see how myths, serving our own need to know origins and purpose, sometimes frustrate our search for the true past. Their authority comes from being traditional and having no other author. They survive in the tradition of the spoken or sung word. So they dramatize our need to know why and our willingness to take poetry for truth. The English word myth derives from the Greek mythos, which meant word in the sense of a final pronouncement. This is the word. Its special meaning appears in contrast with the Greek logos, which meant word, in the sense of a truth that can be argued and demonstrated. So myths are traditional statements of truths. Their anonymous source somehow added to their authenticity. Greek myths, then, were an ancient Vulgate, a popular way of making the past known, as widespread a way of creating belief as journalism is today. And their Vulgate was validated by the consensus of the ages. Just as the journalist nowadays expects the reader to take his word for the truth of the story, so did the ancient bards. Like modern journalists, they too were commonly silent on their sources. Time itself gave authority to their utterances. Paul Ving said, "History is born as tradition, not built up from source materials." Like the bard, the historian, when he begins to appear, also treats himself as a source. But he will have other purpose and find new paths in his search for the true past. It's an important idea. Like the bard, the historian, when he begins to appear, also treats himself as a source. In that way, each of us is a source of history, an important source of history. So to fight that is denying history its due. You and I make a contribution by our very being and presence with the craft. Now, is our future known to us, as the Greeks believed? So we know our future as well as our past. Our past reveals the future, is what they seem to be saying. What does our past reveal about our future that we already know? We have powerful myths, but we haven't done enough yet. There's still more to do to improve the literacy, the Masonic literacy. There's still much more that can be done. The study depends on ability, doesn't it? And we've been taught that. But we were also taught that some must lead and others must follow. The lead here is in your exploration of self, of meaning, of understanding, of logos, the sense of truth that can be argued and demonstrated. Can you prove the truth that you know? Well, of course you can. But it needs work. So we're not going to get drawn away by the study of the Greek philosophers. But the Iliad and the Odyssey are remarkable readings that have been passed down through generations. Yes, quite rightly you're going to say that what we're talking about is fairly contemporary, considered compared to 5,000 years of Chinese culture. Yes, and who would argue? And yes, you're going to say that Socrates and Confucius and were about the same time frame, within 100 years, coming out with very similar ideas. And you'd be right. But we need to have a sense of what those great minds were saying to us. What were they saying to themselves? What truth were they arguing and demonstrating that we haven't read? We don't know their argument, so we couldn't possibly, their reasoning, so we couldn't possibly begin to recognize whether we agree with it or not. So it takes a little bit of study. Do we use scholars that we can trust? Well, yeah. We can't all go back to original Greek writings and translate them. So we need to rely on the best minds, validated by their contemporaries. Do you think if you're inclined to understand more about myth, Joseph Campbell's sense of tells us how important myth is to our own search for meaning, understanding, that moment and idea of complete satisfaction and awareness? What we have learned about the ways of the writers today, the bards in the Balkan Mountains, that's where the Homeric bards once sang. They would sing us the myths. That suggests that there was a stability and continuity in the tales they told. We need that stability and continuity. That means we need people that know those myths and know the arguments, so that they can pass them on and demonstrate them to us. Because that original experience isn't available to us right now. So we see the past. We understand our future. Our future is this quest for knowledge. Our future is to sort out the distractions, the small gains, the things that keep our membership and our fraternity together. Common purpose, always common purpose. Noble deeds. Noble deeds. And a recognition that we can be part of something bigger than ourselves. Absolutely accepting and looking beyond the pettiness of personality struggles around us. Absolutely no criticism that it's there. But to think that it's going to be stamped out, it's like saying that bad manners are going to be stamped out. One day everybody will be mannerly, courteous, and discerning to one another. Oh, you and I have been held to a higher standard already. That's expected of us. And it's expected at your age that you don't need to be told that. That you don't need to be told how. That you begin by paying attention. Get with the program. In other words, listen more than you speak. Speak when you're asked. And go about your purpose without criticizing your fellows, but never expecting that kind of courtesy will be extended to you. That's the mark you make. Do these things because they're the right things to do, not because it's easy. Be who you are as a Mason. And be the influence. When people are acting in bad faith or in bad taste, be the influence of grace and understanding. Be the manners. Be confident that with repeated episodes, repeated effort, the goal of understanding will be achieved. And if you realize that some men do not embrace this view of the future, that the future is known to us, then there's not a great deal that you can do to interfere with their struggle. That's them. And if there's so many that they form a course, that's still them. Here, when the writers, enriched by the creative talents among them, it's not everybody is a creative talent. When they found an attractive version of the myths, they would recreate it for generations. These storylines that we see recreated in our ritual are exactly that. Now, when somebody stands up and gives an interpretation of what's going on, it is not necessarily definitive. You need to, and I, to examine, to consider, to question, to probe, to doubt. That's the scientific method. That curiosity. To ask why. What is the meaning and what do I take from that? We examine the myth, but we become more enriched when we ask the question. Now, if you haven't, if you've been struggling with that comfort zone, struggling with that notion that we achieve these heights of awareness through compliance, then it's time to just realize what the future is revealing as we step into it. We are not compliant with the passage of time, we may be on that curve, bending with it. Conscious, sentient beings with a small window in this level of consciousness that leads to yet another, and what some would say a higher level of consciousness each time, if you believe in that sense of immortality, life moving forward, or that energy. Here, this is a nice little piece that helps our understanding. The Homeric bards have probably reached the stage in the mid-7th century BC, where they had discovered versions of truths that they wanted to reproduce. But the rise of literacy and reliance on fixed texts brought the decline of the spontaneity of the bard. The iode, the singing, to the accompaniment of his lyre-like guitars. They're a little tiny old-fashioned version of a guitar. I was as close as I could come to lyre, L-Y-R-E. He was displaced by the rhapsody, a trained reciter. The rhapsody, which means song stitcher, who appeared in the 5th century, was well-trained and probably had texts of Homer, though he still recited from memory. Rhapsodies then competed for prizes at public festivals, and while the bards were relied on for the authentic traditional myth, the very name rhapsody became a byword for unreliability as they continued to perform and compete for prizes into the 3rd century. The last stage in the degeneration of the tradition of the oral myth, rhapsodies were despised by educated people. Scholars can still detect their awkward additions to the works of earlier Homeric bards. Just think about it, as you're memorizing the work and it's being passed on through the centuries, the original text was modified. It changed a little bit. So the scholars would be upset because they would be working from those original pieces. And they would notice the difference, the spin, if you will. So you think about it, the cost, in a way, of literacy that was provided by fixed text, books, and written material brought a decline in the spontaneity. Before that, the bard would just stand up quite spontaneously and try to capture the idea in his own way, in the moment, sort of riffing on the idea the way jazz does. But the Homeric texts were finally written down at the end of the true oral period, the Dark Ages in ancient Greece. That was from 1100 to 900 BC, long, long time ago. The Dark Age proved well suited for the thriving and transmission of oral poetry, which, unlike architecture, required no prosperity or any particular materials. The rudeness of daily life in an illiterate community that made literary culture impossible was no barrier to the seeking for heroes. Like the Norse sagas, the Homeric epics themselves suggest that ages of hardship and adversity, which reward courage and pride and sheer survival, are fertile for heroic poetry. Here, a soft and gentle voice, as we move on with the show today.
Очи страстные и прекрасные, как люблю я твою сияние, знать увидела. Я не добрый час. Очи черные, очи жгучие, очи страстные и прекрасные. Как люблю я вас, как боюсь я вас, знать увидел вас, я не добрый час. Очи черные, очи пламенные, и манят они в страдание. Где царит любовь, где царит покой, где страдания нет, где вражды я бы прожил жизнь не улыбающись. Вы купили меня, очи черные, унесли навек мое счастье. Очи черные, очи жгучие, очи страстные и прекрасные. Как люблю я вас, как боюсь я вас. Знать увидела, я не добрый час.
What's not to like? What's not to like? Well, Masons of all stripes come together around these convergences. There's something very powerful that we capture through history, the power of knowledge, the confrontation of ignorance, and our own admission, the humbling experience of admitting our own ignorance. When we're talking about being humble in the eyes of the Creator, are we really thinking that's just an abstract external comment? Or is it something much more? Should it be something much more? Why do we bother talking about, why do we even bother talking about the Greek philosophers today? Why? Well, something about their ideas was sufficiently legitimate that we moved those ideas forward. Perhaps eras when other grand outlets of man's thinking and hopes and ambitions are lacking naturally defined expression in the only kind of monument that needs no material resource. And that's the monumental epic. Why would we read the Iliad or the Odyssey? Because it is monumental. There's so much information packed into that. That's why. And it's truths, proven, arguable truths that can't be demonstrated. Can you count on it? Yes. If you take a moment to understand it. Great moments, to paraphrase Walt Whitman, require great audiences. Great monuments require great audiences. that's the Masonic movement is part of that, I think. Great audience. Now, what's the great monument? What is the epic tale? Well, the work and the ritual are statements about monumental creations. What are those monumental creations that gave rootstock, the foundation of our ritual? Many of the special qualities of the Hiramic epics are then easier to understand. The modern reader may feel disappointed that the Iliad and the Odyssey do not hold him in suspense, but always have a familiar outcome, the more familiar and predictable, because the gods are always ready to intervene to produce the predictable result. Me, I like a good ending in my mystery. So in her Homeric epic, there is no uncertainty about the outcome. So people like me love that. Toward which, yeah, I like a mystery, but I like a mystery that leads me to some resolution that I can handle, that gives me some pleasure. It's entertaining. That's why I like the Homer's the epics written up. And toward the gods, it's clear they're going to help with the resolution. Our interest is in the uncertain motives and reactions of the people. The focus is not on the unraveling of an unusually predictable plot, but on the tantalizing uncertainties of the reactions of Achilles or Hector. They're the people. They're you. They're me. The Iliad and the Odyssey recited entire at the annual Panathenaea festival made myth and memory the handmaid of ritual. The myth and memory for the handmaid of ritual. And an affirmation of the communal sense of purpose. What myths speak to us as a craft? What are the monumental myths? Because certainly the audience is waiting. And in some ways, I think the Freemasonry today is a very large audience, almost sold out. The waiting list has shrunk, finally, but it's still not caught up. It's just shorter than it's been for a while. But the audience are seated, waiting for the epic to be revealed, and waiting, and waiting, and waiting. Homer's apotheosis in antiquity as the poet somehow survived in the Middle Ages, even though his works were unknown in the Latin West. Imagine. The Renaissance revival of Greek made the Homeric epics newly available and awakened enthusiasm expressed in translation. George Chapman, who claimed to be directly inspired by the spirit of Homer, was followed by passages of translation by Thomas Hobbes and Quatrains in 1674-75. So the contemporaries pulled together the original purposeness of Freemasonry, passed the work on to, were influenced by the works of Thomas Hobbes and by John Drayden, later in the 17th century. These were things that those learned men were reading. Interest in Homer remained so alive that when the young Alexander Pope, you think of the names, the people that we're talking about here, formidable thinkers, important thinkers. Pope, 1688, he was born, 1744, he died. He published his first volume of his translation containing the first four books of the Iliad in 1715. The excitement was said to be the greatest ever aroused by a book of verse. The King and the Prince of Wales subscribed substantial sums, and the translation actually established Pope's financial independence. It was said that no poet before, except maybe Shakespeare, had been so highly paid, or perhaps has ever since. When the 6 volumes of Pope's Iliad were completed, Pope had received from the publisher the unprecedented sum of £5,320.04. The publisher, Bernard Lintot, played a heroic role. Even after Pope's work was pirated in Holland, Lintot went ahead and printed 7,500 copies of a new edition of his own. And his faith in Pope's Homer was fully justified by the fortune he made from the enterprise, enough to secure for him and his son the posts of high sheriffs of Sussex. So Lintot, the Dutch, said, right, we'll create another translation. And they went toe-to-toe, but Pope's prevailed. And that was, you could see the confidence that the publisher had in the work. It was Keats, one of my favorites, who united the English translator and the Greek epic past in immortality in his sonnet on first looking into Chapman's Homer. And just the first little part goes like this. Then felt I like some watcher of the skies, when a new planet swims into his ken, or like stout Cortez, then with eagle eyes he stared at the Pacific, and all his men looked at each other with a wild surmise, silent upon a peak in Darien. Oh, we should really talk. We'll get around to them. There's lots. Herodotus is coming to mind. We really should speak. And one of my personal favorite, Thucydides. Not to say that we're talking specifically about Freemasonry, but we are. We're talking about the enriched ideas and the validated sense, the validation of these ideas that we think that most people over the centuries believe would lead to an authentic understanding of our past and awareness of our future, a familiarity with the future. No guesswork. It's been an absolute pleasure. Freemasonry is an incredible embodiment of the operational end of these ideas. But operations and good deeds also require the fertility of thought. And so, Masonry, I think, dances forward with a coming out. The coming out now is that it's okay to talk about lofty ideas. It's okay to show up, to be there and support by your presence the events of an organization that targets not necessarily noble deeds, but generosity. It's the generosity that's noble. The widow that we're helping connects us with our past, in our imagination and in our emotion. And it's not the amount, it's the gesture that is important. Our crusade to support some unpopular bits of science makes us aware of noble statements and noble gestures. Again, that together we are far greater than we are when we're alone. Here's a little, we'll go out today with a little bit by Sheila Jordan. Some of you will be familiar with her work. Remarkable voice. In the meantime, please take care of each other. Commit those acts of Masonic kindness. And I look forward to seeing you in just a few short days. into the future.
Then your branches die.